Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Spesh.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
I'm tired.
Makes three of us.
Three of us?
Me, myself, and I.
Yeah.
And you.
I'm good. It's good. It's good. It's I'm enjoying summer. It's been a good summer so far.
It has been.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing a bit of a different show tonight. We've talked about doing this before, but...
Yeah, so, and I've asked, you normally, every time I mention, hey, we should do a compilation. No. It's like,
no,
you're very opposed to it.
New stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody, they want to hear the old stuff. They can go back and listen to the old stuff.
Anyways, you guys are going to hear some old stuff tonight.
You're going to hear old stuff. So the Quiet Adventure Symposium is put on every spring in East Lansing, Michigan. Been doing it 31 years.
Yep.
We've been going for about the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Great show. Lots of speakers, booths, and stuff like that. We enjoy meeting the people that are there that help put the show on, people that have their booths there,
yep,
and the presenters, and, you know, give their...
It used to be called the Quiet Water Symposium, and yep, what, 5 years ago, they went to the
Quiet
Adventure Symposium.
Yep. You know, and of course, all the people that come out and say hello to us while we're,
yeah,
we're there recording our,
well,
booth.
Well, the paddling community is generally they're all like-minded and,
mm-hmm,
a really good group of people. And you see that at the QAS. It's one of my favorite shows to go to. Great people. And the rabbits are next door. That's always nice.
Right. The big old rabbit show.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely become one of the shows that we really look forward to going to every year.
Yes.
So much to my unhappiness, received an email from them recently talking about the future of Quiet Adventure Symposium. Basically, they're saying this event would not be possible without the dedication of the many volunteers who help run the show on the day of the event and the countless hours provided beforehand by an all-volunteer board. Yeah, none of these shows are quick, easy things to put together.
No, it takes a lot of,
right,
time to put them together, a lot of effort, and
mm-hmm,
and when you're doing as a volunteer, it's just the fun of doing it is your compensation.
Mm-hmm. For several years now, the board has faced the difficult reality that this model of putting on the event is unsustainable. Our board members are stretched thin, the overall size of the board dwindling, and we have struggled in efforts to spread the workload required to sustain this event. We have also struggled in attempts to create a financial model that works for our exhibitors and attendees, yet helps us to continue to grow as an organization. And one of the things I've seen and heard from other, not just paddling events, is when events have been going on so long,
the core group,
the
driving
group as
force,
they age out, so,
yes,
to speak,
yeah,
trying to get those new ones to come in and keep
and
it building.
Pick up the baton and run with it.
Yeah,
it's harder to do these days.
And when you're looking at constant cost increases,
oh, yeah,
and everything like that, of course you,
yeah,
you know, what somebody's $20 donation 15
it
years ago
doesn't go as far as it
doesn't
used to
mean as much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
As we consider the future of the symposium, we're reaching out to you, our valued exhibitors and partners, because we believe the strongest path forward will come from working together. To sustain the symposium for future years, we are exploring new approaches to planning and event operations and are seeking partners who may be interested in contributing their expertise, resources, or leadership in event management. We are also seeking new board members to help with overall organizational operations. If you can help or want to volunteer, head to quietadventures.org and see what it is all about, or drop an email to quietadventuressymposium.org. And, yeah, just drop a message and say, hey, I've heard you guys are looking for some people and stuff like that.
It's a worthy event to support. It's,
mm-hmm,
it is run on volunteers. The money that is donated and the money at the door doesn't go as far as it used to. But I guess the key thing is you need a certain core group of dedicated people who several months out can start the planning, a year out can book things, several months out start the planning.
Get some sponsorship.
Get sponsors and get exhibitors and set up the floor plan. And it's not hard work, but it's time consuming and it needs people, driven people. People are dedicated to get these things off the ground. And there's fewer and fewer volunteers to support it these days because, you know, people just, they move on to other things or they can't do it anymore to other commitments. And so there's no fresh people coming in to make that groundswell of support to keep these things successful.
Right. Again, this in East Lansing, Michigan, so not like down the street from us. So it's kind of hard for us to do stuff. So we're doing
reaching out to the greater body of people. Maybe somebody in our listening audience is like, "Hey, I don't live too far from Lansing, Michigan. I could support this. I could come out and help and contact them." And in my experience, it's the generation, our generation, and before that. Somehow they found a lot of time to dedicate to volunteerism and doing stuff like that. You don't see a lot of that anymore. It's
dwindling for sure.
And life is busier these days. There's a lot of different things going on in people's lives. So spare time is hard to come by. So
That, and in my opinion, one of the things is the almighty phone. And
everybody's distracted.
Distracted by phone. Well, I can see all this stuff on a computer screen.
Why would I do that in purpose?
So, let's go in person. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's important to keep these smaller shows like this going. They're a wealth of info for people that want to get out on the water or just outdoors in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these little shows, they're not the big, massive Canucopias and like we go to the Toronto Outdoor Adventure Show. But there's these small little shows that are put on here and there and not the big major center sort of deal. So it's important to keep them going. So that being said, this episode is just going to be some of our favorite interviews from previous years.
Yes. So we'll get together what we feel are our favorite segments from QAS and our favorite interviews, our favorite musical points, and we will share that again, and maybe we can generate some interest in volunteerism to help push QAS into the next decade or two.
Right. And again, quietadventures.org or quietadventuressymposium.org. You can send emails and go to the website there and check it out. With that being said, here is our first favorite memory interview from days gone by. So we are here with Cynthia Donovan. How you doing?
I'm doing quite well, thank you.
You are like the main head cheese queen of the Quiet Adventure Symposium.
I guess you could call me that.
I just did.
They keep making me wear a bright pink hat so everybody can track me down.
And did I track you down today?
Yeah, you got me tracked. I
had people come out and find you.
Exactly.
Yeah, look for the big pink hat.
Yes.
So what is the Quiet Adventure Symposium?
Well, this, in 2025, we're celebrating the 30th year of Quiet Adventure Symposium. It started 30 years ago as a bunch of boat builders and paddlers getting together and having a quiet water symposium.
Okay.
And then we realized there's so many other non-motorized outdoor adventures, which are our mission, that we needed to include the bikers, the hikers, the fishermen, the horse trail riders, and all of these other activities in an event whose mission is basically to connect people, to connect across activities, to connect them to different people who have adventures in foreign countries, who have adventures out west, or have amazing adventures in Michigan. I got involved because I had moved to Michigan. I really didn't know Michigan was as gorgeous as it is.
Right.
And has as many rivers and lakes and everything else. And Ontario's right next door with gorgeous places. So I got involved in presenting initially because we have 30 presenters, all these exhibitors. It is a place, our mission is to connect people to their next adventure, to their next investment in the environment, how to get active in stewardship, how you can learn about invasive species and how you can do something about them if they're important to you. So it's a great way for people to join in, meet with people, and have some great conversations.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things we harp on this year sort of thing is mm-hmm. the getting out in nature,
yeah.
waterway stewardship.
Yep.
And I know there's conservation groups here and
yes.
stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then there are all types of different paddlers here.
Yeah.
And as some of the, like you say, there's bikers and stuff like that. Yeah. I haven't seen any horses walk by, though.
Oh, they're out in the arena. There are two horses in the arena that are going to do training on how horse etiquette and trail etiquette when you're on one of those multi-use trails.
Right.
And you run across horses. What should you do?
Run
What's
screaming.
The best thing? And preferably not run and screaming. So you obviously need to go to that training, Sean.
Right? But yeah, there's yeah. all different yep. types of things here. And
yeah.
as you say, it's all quiet stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
So no motors, no...
Nope.
No, nothing like
nope.
that. Nothing loud.
No, although the event itself is really loud.
The event is loud, and like I say, we're in our nice little tent here now,
yes.
so it stops the big air conditioning above our heads from
yes.
from noise. But I mean, you got you got kayaks, you got dragon boaters,
yeah.
you got conservation groups.
Yep.
You got authors with more types of books than you can shake a stick at.
Absolutely.
I know we talked to Trapper Haskins there about going down the Mississippi
yes.
and all that sort of
yep.
stuff.
Yep.
The gear that you got here, paddles and,
yes.
and stuff,
yeah.
Mustache paddles, like he has
oh,
some beautiful stuff.
Gorge, I just saw somebody walk by and he just bought an old mustache paddle.
You didn't mug
them? No, because I'm sitting here. You got me tied with these headphones. I can't go out and mug. But I really, those
yeah.
old mustache paddles, you just touch them and you stroke them and it's beautiful.
Yeah, he does some great work.
It's great artisan work.
Yeah. But
yep.
there's so much of that stuff here
yep.
and
yep.
Different waterway trails and stuff
yeah.
like that. People help
yep.
you plan trips
yep.
and
yep.
all that. There's so much here. This is really cool.
Yeah.
And this is 30 yeah. years now.
This is 30 years. And it's brought in people from all over the region, including you Canadians,
yep.
who are very welcome at this event. And then you have, people from Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana is far away. I spend my summers in Minnesota, and I know I imported my sister from Minnesota to help. But I know people come. We've got Boundary Waters.
Yes.
Canoe areas represented, for instance. And we've got some of the, some great guides are
yeah.
here. And we've got Power of Water is one of our sponsors of our
yep.
grand prize raffle. I went to Ireland with them and did sea kayaking, and I got to know them being here at this event.
Right.
Is how I met different outdoor guides, different, and got a chance to look at different boats, decided I'd rather not be underwater doing their whitewater kayaking, and
right.
shifted to sea kayaking because I saw the adventures here.
Yeah, I prefer to be on the water, not under it.
Yeah, I was in my paddling class for whitewater. I was called the submarine queen because I had long hang time waiting for someone to come rescue me because I didn't have a role.
I can now hold my breath for 4 minutes.
Exactly.
Well, you know what? It's funny because I came down here because somebody told me about it. I said, well, I'm not doing anything this weekend. I came down for a day trip 2 years in a row.
Uh-huh.
And then the third year, we're like, well, let's... We were contacted and said, hey, why don't you, like, set up and record here?
Yeah.
I said, okay. So we came down, and we've been coming... I think this is our fifth year
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is.
Doing this. And it's great to just sit here and, you know, chit-chat with people
yeah.
about paddling yep. and different things. And we talked about moose and...
The Isle Royale,
yeah,
the moose and wolf
moose
dynamics
and, wolf stuff,
and that
yeah.
history. It's fascinating
yeah.
history.
Yeah, talking
yep.
about kayaking and,
yep.
and all that sort of
yep.
stuff
yep.
and different paddling.
Yep.
And then you get music going on here now with Jerry Vandiver and Caitlin Evanson.
Yep.
And
yep.
like Cliff Jacobson on his farewell tour.
I know. I got to get over there and see Cliff Jacobson
right?
in the next few minutes. So that's great.
And I'm presenting this year, too.
You're presenting.
It's
exactly.
my second time presenting.
It is your second
yeah.
time. Exactly.
You know more about me than
exactly.
I know about me.
I just have to know the event
right?
inside out. You know, it's my role.
You know, we love coming down here. We love seeing this. It may not be as big as a Canucopia thing.
No. No.
But you know what? There's enough here
yeah.
for a great day
yeah.
and get
yeah.
so much information.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it continuing for many, many more years.
I hope so. I mean, that's the goal. When I came on board, Gary Dukakis, who they've only had two other previous presidents in 30 years. They had Russ Hicks, who was there in the founding and helped organize it with Raup's Outfitters. And then Gary Dukakis came on board, and, you know, I'm half the size of half the height of Gary Dukakis.
I'm 6 feet tall, and I think I'm half his
exactly.
size.
Exactly. So when I took over, the goal was to figure out after COVID how to keep the symposium moving forward. But what was great about that timing is that's when people started doing a lot more outdoor, a lot more paddlers, and then a lot more investment in the environment, which is critical for us. Is we've got Michigan Waterway Stewards, if you haven't talked to them, would be great to talk to, because they've done a lot of investment in getting communities together to get the waterways clean and great waterways to paddle on and to hike along and bike along.
Well, people take pride in it if they start getting into it, right?
They really do. And that's actually, we get so many volunteers, and the reason the volunteers come to the symposium is because they take pride in and joy in what the symposium gets them in terms of connecting and meeting people just like them.
Right.
Who want to be outdoors and don't want to motor between them and the outdoors.
Yeah. And coming here, they can ask the questions and find out what's, you know, do they want to go kayak or do they want to go canoe?
Exactly.
Right? Do they want to go way back country or they're more of a day tripper sort of thing? So it's nice to come here and and ask the questions and get the information.
Yep.
Well,
it's good.
You seem to be doing something, right?
Thanks, Sean.
Working out.
Aw, that's great. We love having you here, and I look forward next year to having Derek here with you.
Me too.
I wish him his best. we miss him, but it'll be great to have the two of you. You can come alone if you need to. That's always welcome.
Yeah, my wife says I have to bring Derek with me when I can.
Oh, I think she's right.
We're not trying to say too much about Derek, because then his head just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
And then he doesn't fit in the car.
Then he doesn't fit in the car anymore.
Yeah. And it's a long drive.
And I got to drive with Kevin Callen.
Yeah, that's always a joy.
Right?
you laugh a lot.
Yes. Thank you very much, Cynthia.
Thank you, Sean, for the opportunity. Yep, take care.
You too. So we're sitting with Joni McGuffin. How are you doing, Joni?
Oh, just fine. It's wonderful to be here at the Quiet Adventure Symposium.
It's been, this is our second year recording here, but this is my, fourth year?
Yeah.
This is your third time, Derek?
Yes.
This is my fourth time coming here, and it's just the rabbit show that always draws us.
That's the exciting part, the rabbits.
Yeah, it's all about the rabbits, man.
I love going in and see the rabbits.
Well, the first time I was at the show, our daughter, who's now 20, was just a baby. And we had a big canoe set up, and she was sleeping in the canoe. And then every year, she would come, and everyone would see, a little older, a little older, a little older.
Awesome.
She grew up coming to Quiet Water.
That's pretty cool, because this is their 25th year, right?
25th year.
Yeah.
25.
Yeah. I know. It's amazing.
And it's the first year with a new name, I believe.
Quiet Adventure Symposium.
Yeah, I might call it Quiet Waters. That's right. It's Quiet Adventures.
Yeah. I've been doing that all weekend, still trying to get that out of your head.
Yes.
Yeah. Quiet Adventures Symposium.
Yes.
So you are going to talk to us today about the Canoes for Conservation.
Sure.
To start.
Yeah.
So what is Canoes for Conservation?
Canoes for Conservation is an initiative of our Lake Superior Watershed Conservancy, our land trust. And we wanted to, as we get into more history about the Conservancy, it'll start to make even more sense. But we wanted to get people out on the water in a safe, inclusive, accessible way with interpretive guides.
Oh, wow.
And a big 36-foot canoe is an awesome way to do that.
Yes.
Last year was our inaugural year on the St. Mary's River and the eastern shore of Lake Superior. And we can take up to 14 people in the 36-foot canoe. And it's so stable, a platform. We had we had lots of elderly people, lots of people who've never paddled before, lots of people, different age groups. So you had grandparents with grandkids and so on. Anyways, I love this one woman who said, she's 85, And she said, I haven't been in a boat since I came across from Italy 60 years ago.
Oh, wow.
In a boat.
Yeah. And then she's in this big 36-foot.
She's in a 36-foot canoe holding a paddle in her hands.
So. Nice. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're paddling radio, you know. It's just how do we... I grew up going to a cottage in Muskoka. My husband, Gary, a cottage on Rabbit Lake in Temagami. And those kinds of growing up things at a camp or a cabin were just what she did in Northern Ontario.
Right.
And there's so many people now who've never, ever had those kinds of experiences.
Exactly.
And so they're adults. And the idea of getting in a canoe, like even like a two-person canoe, it's a big step for
it's
them.
Intimidating, it's yeah. scary, it's
yeah. 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 Whereas so what we would do with the big canoe is for our interpretive tours, they're 1.5 hour to 3 hour tours on the St. Mary's River in Sault Ste. Marie. It's a Canadian Heritage River, and it's so like people learn about the culture and ecology of the region. They get all decked up with the right PFD and the paddle, and they get in the canoe. And one of our guides, Peter, he always walks along the edge of the canoe just to show people how stable this canoe is. And then, you know, everybody gets going. And I was amazed at how little of a geography footprint we were taking up for an hour and a half tour. And then the longer ones we would do connected between the Canadian Heritage Locks. The Sioux Locks is part of Parks Canada.
Right.
And we go through the locks, and we, Whitefish Island, known with Batchewana First Nations, Whitefish Island. And it's an amazing experience out there, because that is the only outflow to the largest freshwater lake in the world, the St. Mary's River.
Right.
And so you've got the rapids there, and you're only looking at like a small percentage of what used to be the rapids. And so we do some stuff out there. We've got food and drink, you know. It's just like making a kind of a really neat. We have cedar tea, and we have smoked whitefish, and then we take people down to the Bush Plain, Canadian Bush Plain Heritage Center.
Right.
We incorporated that. And yeah, we're putting in another dock this summer so we can connect with the new Anishinaabeg Discovery Center.
Okay.
It's right at Algoma University, and there's a great exhibit there about when it was a residential school. And so we'll have more of Indigenous programming this year. And yeah, it's very exciting.
So how long do the tours usually last?
Well, anywhere from an hour and a half to 3 hours. Definitely ones that go up the lake. Like one of the tours is paddling out to see the pictographs that's out from Sinclair Clove on the eastern side of Lake Superior in Lake Superior Provincial Park.
Okay.
And so most people, they just access seeing the pictographs by walking there. It's a very rugged trail, and so that's really challenging for a lot of people. Whereas if you get in the big canoe, now you have this whole experience in the way the painters, the original people who painted on that great canvas of rock. It's one of the best pictograph sites in all of Northern Ontario. And you approach it on the water, and you know, just being on Lake Superior and seeing, and you get to see some of the pictographs that you can't see if you are on foot, because
right.
there's a ledge that goes along beneath, and it ends, and some of the pictographs are around behind where the ledge
okay,
is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
So that's really a lot of fun too. Yeah, Batchewana Bay, Pancake Bay, like really simple stuff.
And a lot of these were along the old Voyageur routes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of the North Shore of Lake Superior was paddled for paddled for thousands of years. I always want to make sure we understand that. And the Indigenous people who live there today, who have lived there for thousands of years, these are the homelands. And they're very spiritually significant places. But then when the fur trade started, and you had the big Voyageur canoes, so I like to call our canoe the big canoe as opposed to a Voyageur canoe,
yeah.
but people would think of it as a Voyageur canoe. And people, yeah, paddled into all those bays, places like Pancake, Agawa Bay. There were old fur trading posts. There's an old fur trading post at Mishpocotten Harbor, where the Mishpocotten River It's the longest running fur trade out of Lake Superior happened there.
Right.
And near Wawa.
Yep.
Yeah, so there's a lot of history along the coast. And
we've done the camping at Pancake and Batuana and up through, you know, Rabbit Blanket and Old Woman Bay. We've been up there and did the Agua Rocks and saw the pictographs there and everything. And it's really a lot of history, lot of history.
Well, I think one of the marvelous things is I think there's a huge presence of the indigenous history there.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's not just the pictograph paintings, it's the whole, it's the lake, it's the land, it's the people that are there who live there now, have always lived there. Whether we go through Batuana First Nations territory or Missinaba Cree First Nations territory, or we get up around Beetagong, Anishinaabeg, up around the Pukasaw area.
Right.
Every community has their stories and they're all Ojibwe, but the language is all very pertinent to their specific landscape that they are in. And when we've done some of our interpretation and we get it, you know, translated, we have to go to local speakers and talk to them. And anyways, the water trail is another big story besides Canoes for Conservation.
Yeah.
But the Canoes for Conservation was a way to bring the water trail to life, like I said, on Lake Superior in a safe, accessible, inclusive way.
So how did you come about creating this? Where did the land trust come from?
The land trust is the Lake Superior Watershed Conservancy. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it is not just the lake. It's actually the watershed. And so it's actually almost 16 years now. I go back a long way on the lake. My husband Gary and I, to go even further back, first met Lake Superior in 1983-84 when we paddled across Canada.
Right.
And so that was our first. We came up through the locks. We came out onto this largest expanse of fresh water on Earth. We were entirely intimidated, as everybody is, about Lake Superior. You need a lot of respect to be on that lake. And we paddled from Sault Ste. Marie to Thunder Bay in 10 days. That's 500 miles.
Wow.
We were going, like, getting up at 4:30 in the morning because we heard, you know, the weather was the best to paddle in the morning. And we'd just go all day, and we happened to have really calm weather for most of it.
So it was ideal,
and
yeah.
So
yeah.
we just went for it. So, like, it was just kind of a blur. And but we always said we would come back, and we just absolutely fell in love with Lake Superior. So in 1989, we took solo canoes, and we paddled around Lake Superior, and that took us 3 months. And that's how we got to really know the lake as a whole. And that's where I come back to the Lake Superior Watershed Conservancy, is we looked at it like it wasn't the boundaries that we set with the U.S. and Canada, they're artificial. Political boundaries are artificial comes to the ecosystem. So we look at all of the Great Lakes. And we look at Lake Superior, it feeds all the lower Great Lakes. And it's so important to the health of the lower Great Lakes. If we took the watershed of all of the Great Lakes and we made it a country, it would be the third richest country in the world. And that's because of the fresh water at its heart. And there's like 750,000 people on Lake Superior. It's not a big population. We have the cleanest of the lakes. It's the deepest and it's the greatest expanse of fresh water on the planet. And there's over 200 rivers that flow into the lake and only one that flows out, the St. Mary's, as I was telling you. And the origination of the Lake Superior Watershed Conservancy was the idea of creating a land trust that would be for the health and well-being of this as a big picture. It's not just one little piece of the lake. It's like, because everywhere you affect the lake, where the waters are flowing in, whether it's a river or it's a piece of the coast or it's a city on the coast, it's all just one big watershed.
Exactly, exactly.
So we formed the Conservancy as a land trust with a board of directors that has U.S. and Canada board of directors.
Right.
And it represents, we're founded as two organizations under the IRS and the Canada Revenue Agency, but we actually operate sort of as one organization.
A lot of communication.
So it gives us a lot of latitude to be able to do a lot of cool things.
Right.
So I don't know. So, so I keep talking.
No.
That's why you're here.
Because I'd like to go from like the creation, you know, what your original goals were, like, and now you're moving forward into the future. What do you hope that this can bring forth? What is your future goals for this conservancy?
Well, when we started this conservancy, we didn't have the kind of technology and the communication that we have today.
Yes.
Like, just even doing a meeting with Zoom or something like that, where you can bring people in around this big geography. We were constantly having to travel to get to places,
right.
And that was really challenging. And we thought, this is a huge mouthful that we've bitten off here. And so we started with, you know, the dream of what we could do in terms of protecting areas. And we do have some preserves, so protecting land is something that we can do under our bylaws.
Right.
We have education. And we also have, like, what's become a really big piece of this is the experiential part. Well, we started with Canoes for Conservation. That was born out of a part of the Trans-Canada Trails Great Trail.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they came to us in 2013 and were wondering how they were going to finish this big gap in the Trans-Canada Trail, which was the north shore of Lake Superior. So there's a lot of really cool hiking sections along the trail.
Right.
And they had been worked on for many years. Like, there's the Voyageur Trail Association's been around for 40 years. But we know, Gary and I knew, like, having walked the Appalachian Trail, which is a 2,000-mile footpath, mm-hmm. that you need, there's 9,000 people as volunteers that keep that trail open.
Wow.
You've got to walk a trail to keep it open.
Exactly.
And we don't have the population on the North Shore to connect that trail anytime soon. But there are these amazing sections, of walking trail. And we saw, you know, the obvious way to get this done by our sesquicentennial in 2017 is to make it a water trail, because nature has built the trail. What we need for that trail, though, are access points. And
exactly.
So we came up with a strategy of 16 main access points. These wouldn't be about your camping wilderness spots. They would be the places you could drive to, park your car, and get on the water.
Right.
So then we looked at what are the types of things that we need for making that work. We need... Kevin
Callan. Hey, Kev.
Hey, buddy.
Hi, Kevin.
Disturbing the podcast.
Gotta love Kevin.
We just had Kevin Callan swing by and do some video.
I know Kevin for a lot of years.
Access points.
Yeah, so yes. Access points. The really exciting piece of this was that we said, okay, so we're going to work with all these different communities. We ended up with 16 partners that included Pakistan National Park, two provincial parks, and then 11 communities and two lighthouses. So so as an NGO. So and an indigenous community too, Beektagong Nishnabeg up near Pakistan. So this was a really exciting and huge project for us to take on. We're a small organization, and we were going to be the oversight to 1,000 kilometers of this 25,000 kilometer trail that goes ocean to ocean to ocean. So it was a really big opportunity for us to unite the vision of bringing this lake together. And doing something really practical that we knew a lot about, which was paddling.
Yes.
So what we did at these access points, we looked at the site, and we got a wonderful woman. Actually, she's here today in Michigan. She's from Michigan, Cindy Burkhauer. who looked at our sites to make them universally accessible.
Perfect.
So we wanted from the parking lot to the docks to be accessible, and making things accessible for someone in a wheelchair makes it accessible for everybody. The pathways are, the material for the pathways makes them walkable for everybody, whether you're,
right.
you know, elderly or you've got children with you. They're wide enough so that you can carry your two kayaks with your friend. Everything about the design of the site was really imperative that we look at universal access. So that was the starting point. And then we said, what do everybody need? They need washrooms. They need the docks. They need picnic tables. They need, some kind of interpretive signage. So we put a package together and figured out what are we going to do for each one of these sites.
Right.
So not everybody had the, Scriber, for instance, was not a good place with its big, steep, rocky beaches to have a dock.
Right. Yeah. No, exactly.
But
yeah.
Another place like Grocap, which is a harbor, or Terrace Bay. Terrace Bay is a great example because that little community off the Slate Islands, it's quite famous for the Slate Islands, but it's on the North Shore. And once they put in the Universal Access Dock and the Water Trail Access Point, they were able to match funding and get a whole lot more docks. It's an amazing site today. They've got lots of docking for everybody, and it's made a really great water trail access point. And other places like Thunder Bay are putting in docks this year, universal access docks, which they didn't at the time.
Right.
And it gave communities a way to work together too, like Red Rock and Nipigon are not that many miles apart, but they weren't connected with one another. Well, the water trail connects them. They each have a water trail access point, and then they have great hiking trails. So,
well, you figure Thunder Bay
yeah.
would have some sort of access.
Well, they do, but it wasn't really, now that it's dedicated as part of the Great Trail,
right?
The Trans-Canada Trail's the Great Trail, that made it, gave it that, personality as being part of the whole of an ocean-to-ocean-to-ocean trail. And it's significant because Thunder Bay is, it's sort of the ending point to our part of the trail.
Right.
But when you get there, you pick up a bicycling trail. Then you pick up the Path of the Paddle Trail. And it's different type of paddling because you're going inland.
Right.
There's a really, I guess, I'm sorry, I'm mumbling.
No.
With the a city like Thunder Bay, it's really the only main, it was the only main city on the trail that we worked with. And their resources were, they've got a really nice harbor. They've been really working on their waterfront. They have the Kaministiquia River and the old, Fort William Historical Park. So all these attributes, but they're often, they're not connected, but they are connected by the water.
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff happening on the Thunder Bay waterfront now. It's really exciting, and so our water trail is just part of that experience. So
you are you're a charitable nonprofit.
Yeah.
So for a lot of the funding for a lot of these improvements and going forward.
Yeah.
So signing up for these water tours and stuff is a form of the funding, I assume. So do you get government funding, and like how do we pay
for the access points? Yeah.
The Conservancy itself, because we're nonprofit in Canada, the United States, we have funders, donors, and so on as part of it to keep the doors open at the Conservancy. And a big project like this, we put in $1.2 million worth of infrastructure.
Wow.
And we oversaw that, but Trans-Canada Trail, it was TD Bank, it was the federal government, it was the Ontario Trillium Foundation, and Northern Ontario Tourism was a wonderful partner in it. And so some of those bigger bigger projects, you know, you need big partners.
Yeah.
When we started Canoes for Conservation last year, Northern Ontario Heritage Fund and FedNor and the City of Sault Ste. Marie helped step up. And Grey Owl Paddles, a wonderful paddle company out
Absolutely,
of Cambridge,
yes.
Ontario. Brian Dorfman, who we've known for many, many years, stepped in and provided us with not only some funding, but all the paddles that we needed for our two canoes. And we were able to get... Sparky's waving at me here. A little land trust like ours, like we're not a big organization.
No.
We have three people on right now. We're situated out of Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario in Sault, Michigan. And we dream of being an organization that is basin-wide, especially through the water trail. If you look at our exhibit that we have here at Quiet Adventure Symposium, you'll see the map, and it's got all the water trails that are around Lake Superior. So there's our section of the Great Trail, the Lake Superior Water Trail, that goes from Gros Cap all the way around Thunder Bay. Then you pick up the Path of the Paddle. Then you pick up the Minnesota Lake Superior Water Trail. Then you pick up the Wisconsin Water Trail, the Keweenaw Water Trail. There's all these water trails, and they're on our map, all different colors. We, as a Lake Superior Watershed Conservancy organization that is set up for the watershed, we actually have the mandate and ability to actually connect all these water trails together. So that's a dream of ours, is to see it as an Appalachian Trail of water trails.
Exactly.
Wow.
Where it would have that consistency, because the messaging is so hard when you go from one place to another, even just getting around Northern Ontario. There's been so much work in the last few years with Northern Ontario Tourism to recognize that we have an absolutely world-class landscape. You know, it's second to none in the world, and we don't have an economy that matches that.
Right.
We do have a very rich tourism economy in Northern Ontario, but it's largely been a resource-based industry economy where we have pulp and paper mill towns. We have, you know, forestry and mining. There's a huge amount of government subsidization that goes into those industries, though. And as essential as those industries are, the tourism industry actually brings in more than all of them combined.
And it's not subsidized.
And it's not subsidized. And if you could put all the money that's brought into to tourism, and particularly Northern Ontario tourism, was able to go back into the industry, people in this industry should be wealthy.
Exactly. Yeah.
But most of them do it as a love of life and heart, and they love the people, they love what they do, and we have an amazing network of outfitters like all across Northern Ontario that offer so many different types of things. This Canoes for Conservation just is one little piece of
one
a
little
bigger
piece.
Picture.
It helps enlighten people and make people aware of the need for the conservancy. And we don't communicate very well when it comes to the water trails and nonprofits and so on. Like, you always see that the logging industry and so on, they get what they want. They have the money behind them. And I think what we need to do is communicate better for our natural areas and lakes and watersheds, to preserve that for future generations. Is if we don't use it, we're going to lose it. If we don't talk about it, nobody's going to know about it. So this is something that we have to communicate better. We have to socialize better amongst the population, so that people can get out and use it and make it useful and preserve it for future generations. And this is fantastic that the Lake Superior Watershed Conservancy is helping communicate that need to preserve the backcountry, the waterways and the water trails. And I think this is a fantastic thing that you guys are doing.
Well, one of the things I'd love to add to what we're doing to expand on, well, the Canoes for Conservation, or whether it's the snowshoe winter walks that we're doing, is that interpretation is really critical, and having guides is really critical. it's one of the areas that we're really missing out on. And so, like, if you take the Canadian Rockies, for instance, all the national parks out there, you have to have your guide certification in the Interpretive Guide Association to work in the parks. This isn't, it's certainly you need the skills for the canoeing or the hiking or the paddling or whatever it is that you're doing, the kayaking. But you also, by having that ability to interpret well, tell stories, be able to develop themes, make it exciting for people, learn how to make it relevant to people in this day and age, is to your audience, is one of the most critical features. Because like I started, when we started talking, I mentioned I went to a cottage when I was growing up. And so did Gary. And so innately know about wild places and making your way around in the forest or along the shorelines. It's just home to you. Whereas if people don't grow up with that kind of thing, they're afraid of nature.
Yes, afraid, and it makes them nervous, they're unaware.
Yeah, and whether it's the little insects that we're looking at, it's the birds that we're listening to, it's the rocks that we're picking up, it's everything that you can learn with two really good interpretive guides. It's safe, and it's it makes the whole experience a richer, more, I guess, when you get back to that being able to preserve the land, that messaging comes through because people get enthused about, like, what they're experiencing.
Yes.
It goes in their heart. It's not just information and knowledge and so on. It's that somebody shows you how to use your senses again.
Exactly.
So you learn how to listen, and what are those birds we're listening to? You learn, like, to touch the rocks and look at them and feel them and think about, like, the deeper stories that they have to tell.
Yeah.
But you need some guides to be able to do that. So one of the things we started was an Interpretive Guide Association chapter on Lake Superior.
Okay.
And getting people to be certified as interpretive guides. So we did that last year, and we graduated 15 guides, and we're going to be doing it this year in Sault Ste. Marie and in Thunder Bay. And we're just really, you know, excited about bringing that kind of economy, because it's a really good economic base. Having people, you're well paid as an interpretive guide.
Okay, yeah.
And so my earphones are falling out. That's part of it, is that people always say, well, this doesn't bring in a lot of economy. Actually, guided interpretive experiences really do. And that's what Canoes for Conservation is. And we employed 5 guides last year, and it's small. But, like, if everybody started doing that, and you had big canoes at every single community, and you had a big canoe, you had 5 interpretive guides that, well, they have to spell each other off, and you're doing these experiences, now you're getting all those people who just come. They arrive, they don't have any gear with them, they don't have any experience. They're not going to just get in a kayak or a canoe. Lots of them aren't.
No.
But they can get in this big canoe, they can have this experience, and it's a jumping off then to being aware of this area. Maybe they'll come and they'll do more. They'll go bicycling, they'll go hiking, they'll learn about the different areas to explore.
Exactly. So you're just drawing the people out, you're creating a new experience, and the more people come, the more you're bringing tourism dollars to communities that would be underserved normally for stuff like this. So it's win-win for everybody all around. The tourism comes in and they see a new experience. They experience something new, something different. They learn about the local community, the local watersheds, and
local foods.
Exactly.
The history of the area as well.
Yes.
Yeah. That would be my big thing, is learning about the history of the area.
Yeah.
And if you got an interpretive guide that knows that area, that's huge.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? And that may, like you say, branch you off. Oh, they were talking about this on our tour. I'm going to go check that out. Going to just go on from there. And then, you know what? Even get the people that would go into a different area, a different access area, and do a tour there, and then farther up and learn the whole coast.
That's exactly what we want to see happening. And the more we share and collaborate with one another, the better. And some back to the richness of our indigenous culture of this whole region, you can just see how that in and of itself is an amazing interpretive experience. and having Indigenous guides sharing foods, sharing music, sharing stories.
That would be amazing. That's awesome.
It's a very, very rich just way to live life.
Yes.
Yeah. A rich experience.
Awesome experience.
For everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely fantastic experience it would be.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to find out more about it, where do they go?
Well, superiorconservancy.org is our website. I would say that's the, just jump right in there and you'll find Canoes for Conservation. You'll find out about some of our land trusts.
Okay.
Because one of the things, we're a mechanism for protecting land.
Right.
So one of our wonderful preserves is actually the Lake Superior Provincial Park. There's a group of islands called the Gargantua Islands, 20 islands. You'll see them on our website, and very fun paddling, part of the water trail, very spiritually significant to Indigenous peoples of our region. We're just, you'll see some of that, and you'll see about the water trail. And
awesome. Oh, well, thank you very much. It's great to have you out to talk to us. We've talked to you in the past about this over the last few years, but it's nice to actually get you talking to us about it so that we can help spread the message and socialize this message to the community and to the people and help grow and help support you.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the time today for you having me. I think that Lake Superior is a very remarkable place on this planet, and the people who live here, whether it's on the U.S. side, the Canadian side, or within our Indigenous nations, we have a lot to gain economically, but historically, culturally, and the whole richness of the region needs to be mined in a different way.
Exactly. Yeah. Precisely. That's a perfect way to put it.
Yes. And I do like the fact that it's both sides of the lake.
Yes.
You know, we're not just talking about Canada. We're not just talking about the United States.
Both.
It's both sides.
It's important that you have cooperation across the border to... You can't... If you try to preserve one side, you're going to be battling the other side.
Yes.
So it's one cohesive unit to protect the Lake Superior, right?
Yeah.
So.
And that's why you can see with the water trail how critical that is, because a water trail would be that one common bond that we would have all connected as one entity around the whole lake. So you call it the Lake Superior Water Trail. And now it's like that thread of that eco-cultural tourism thread.
Right.
And as you have all those different experiences all around the lake, we share amongst us all. It's a wonderful dream, and it's starting to come together.
Yes.
That's cool. That's really cool. Well, Joni, thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime you have more information to send our way, we'd be happy to share it with our listeners.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
All right.
We're sitting with Andrea Graham, and she is the granddaughter of Verlin Kruger. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
So, now, up in Canada, we have big collections of canoes and stuff like that. Like, Bill Mason is one of the big guys. And they try to say, what are you going to do with all this stuff? What are you going to do with all this stuff? Let's throw it in the Canadian Canoe Museum, sort of deal. Your grandfather has all this stuff, and when he passed, no one really knows what to do with it, but you... Because there's, I don't know, you guys really have a canoe museum or something down this way.
You're trying to create a lasting legacy, right?
Right.
Yes. So after my grandfather passed away, my mother and I went and kind of raided his office and took some of the canoes and placed that at the Asaba River Center, where it was housed for about 15 years. And then 2 years ago, we went and picked up that collection. The board had changed, and they decided to use the space differently. And we thought, well, what are we going to do with these contents now? So the contents included three of his most notable trips, the Ultimate Canoe Challenge with Steve Landick, the Cross-Continent Canoe Safari with Clint Waddell, and then the Two-Continent Canoe Trip with Valerie Fons. So those three canoes we have, and we have a lot of support items that go along with it. And now we are looking for a permanent host site. However, in the meantime, we have decided to create a mobile museum. So we would like this traveling museum to go to different functions and just to put him back out there and for people to see what he has accomplished and to be inspired by that.
Well, and that's the big thing we're talking about is the Verlin Kruger Award, and he's a part of the Quiet Adventure Symposium and all that sort of stuff for years. I mean, that's the one name that, ever since we've been coming here, that's the one name that's been constant that we've heard. Right.
Yes, he would attend the symposium back when it was called, you know, Quiet Water.
Yep.
And then the first year that they had the Verlin Kruger Award, he was awarded it.
I think he had an in.
I know. I think it was his name. And I believe it was the year or the year after that he passed away. And so, yeah, every year since then, they've been doing that award. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you're familiar with Portland, Michigan, but there's the Verlin Kruger Memorial there.
Yep.
With the bronze statue, and which was created by Derek Rainey. And we had this Kruger, Verlin Kruger Memorial Committee that was just amazing in putting that together.
Right. So now you're trying to get all this stuff together, trying to raise funds to find out, you know, eventually start with the traveling.
Yes.
And then eventually find a space for it for permanent.
Yes. So our goal, or what I would like to say our mission statement, is to preserve the legacy, the stories and accomplishments of Verlin Kruger. And we would say he is arguably the canoeing's greatest of all time, because of course I'm going to say that, I'm his granddaughter. But we want to inspire future generations to appreciate nature, quiet water sports, and human potential. And it's so true. Like, his story is so inspiring. I was just telling somebody about his story the other day, and they just took it in their own way. As an author, they were struggling to put out books, and it was like, wow, that was really great. Like, keep trying, keep going, don't give up.
Mm-hmm. So if people want to find out information on about what you're doing, if they want to help donate or whatever, where would people go?
I'd love for you to go to KrugerLegacy.com. We have just started out, but we're hoping to raise funds then to purchase a trailer that we will make into a mobile exhibit.
That'd be kind of cool.
Right on, yeah.
Yep.
And then you go to the people.
Yeah, we would go to the people.
Yeah.
So you don't have to go to a building somewhere, but we would enjoy going out to others and sharing a little bit about his life. Of course, we wouldn't be able to put a lot into that trailer. And eventually, our end goal is to find a permanent host site for the entire collection.
Yeah. But even if you had the traveling display, you could change stuff up as you go around,
right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We sure could. Yeah. We just happen to have things like the molds and plugs and, like, you know, one of his old aluminum canoes that he, you know, paddled, and canoes that have been on the Grand River Expedition, and, you know, different ones that maybe have been raced. And so there's a lot of different things that we could share with others.
Is there any of the old items that belonged to your grandfather that you're still searching for? So is there stuff out there in the wild?
Oh, there's a lot of stuff out there in the wild.
I say that because in case somebody does hear this and are wondering, I've got Verlin Kruger's this, paddle that, or something, right? So maybe they could reach out and say, hey, if there's a lasting legacy, maybe we can donate these items back.
Oh, I would love that. My husband might say, hold on, where are we going to put that right now? But, yeah, he's great. He's going to be great about it. Yes, there are things that we do not have. We don't have a lot on his racing career, and so that would be cool. And he built, you know, some wood strip racing canoes and back in the day. So that I don't know that we have anything like that in our collection right now.
Oh, okay.
So if people happen to be looking through stuff and know that they've got that.
Exactly.
Well, you know, it could be anything, too. I know that we have a variety of different paddles because he used to design and make his own paddles. And they started out, you know, with a very straight shaft, and then they began to bend, you know, so they looked more like...
They developed over time.
Yes, they did. Things he did... go through a lot of different designs, and he just kept improving until it was like the best fit for him.
Yes.
And then it ended up being a really great fit for other people too. And then we'd hear stories about, I got into a Kruger canoe and I just decided I loved it and I had to have one. They thought they loved the canoe they had before that, but nope. but got into a Kruger, and that was the end
there
for them.
Go. They were wrong the first time.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, hopefully everything comes together. If you can give us the website one more time where people can find the information.
Sure. It's KrugerLegacy.com.
Perfect. Andrea, thank you. And
thank you.
We'll post it on our Facebook page and everything as well. And
perfect.
Hopefully people can touch base with you and this becomes a reality.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us. Appreciate
yes,
it.
Thank you.
Sitting with me now is Stephanie. Stephanie came up to me and said, hey, do you paddle over shipwrecks? I'd rather paddle over them than under them. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
So who are you? Who are you with? What do you do?
Okay, my name is Stephanie Gondula. I'm a maritime archaeologist. So I get to study the amazing history underneath the water. And I'm with NOAA's Thunder Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And we are based out of Alpena, Michigan. So just about an hour and a half south of the Straits of Mackinac.
Okay.
And we protect 4,300 square miles of northwestern Lake Huron.
Awesome. Now, how many wrecks do you know?
I do know. In fact, we just recently announced the discovery of the 100th shipwreck within that 4,300 square miles. Really cool thing is we are still looking for shipwrecks. So we estimate there's at least that many more yet to be found.
Wow. Now, we're talking off air where a couple of years back we go to Tobermory with our kayaks and paddle over wrecks and stuff like that. And just being able to look down and see all this stuff. And I mean, surprisingly shallow and clear water. So you can see all this stuff. What's the fascination with paddling over wrecks?
Oh, goodness. What a great question. So what is the fascination? I have so many answers, so many ways to go. Because, you know, my background is in history and archaeology. And so each of those shipwrecks tells a story, right? And to see that up close and personal. Like you, as a paddler, we know what it's like. You're so connected to the water, right? You really can't do much more. A different activity that connects you that much to the water. But then to see that remnant of our rich Great Lakes maritime history right there, just a few feet away from you, and those stories that those shipwrecks hold. So I guess it's the compelling history, right?
Right.
And it is a tragic thing, these shipwrecks, of course. But it also tells us a story of the thousands of people that survived on the Great Lakes, living on the Great Lakes, working on the Great Lakes, that built our American economy. So it's an insight into the daily lives of people that we don't often hear about.
Right.
So there's one reason. I mean, it's also just super cool. It's not a unique, but a really rare experience to be able to see something that was built 150, 200 years ago.
Yes.
You really get an insight into the technology that put together a 200-foot-long wooden freighter that would carry 1,000 tons of grain, for example.
You don't know how it could carry that much just because of figuring that kind of weight.
Wow, for sure. Yeah, so it's really interesting if you're into the ship construction technology. You can see timbers and fasteners and sometimes even boilers. So there's another reason.
Well, you know what? And there's nothing like paddling and then being able to look down and seeing something. And as you say, I mean, except in rare cases where they'll, you know, sink a boat for an artificial marine reef or something like that. They are, when you think about it, all tragic stories. Right?
Well, they are mostly accidental sinkings, but there are a number, especially in the shallower waters that we'll get to see while paddling, that were deliberate abandonments. In fact, there's a place just off the shores of Alpena that is nicknamed the Boneyard.
Okay.
And it's where a number of vessels were deliberately abandoned. So it's like kind of like you think of a junkyard for cars. Your car is, you know, it's old and it's like you're going to go get a new one. So why even bother with the old one? And you just leave it by the roadside. Of course, we don't really do that. But you would leave it. That's what they did. They had these old ships and they'd strip the machinery, you know, take the expensive stuff off and then just shoot a hole in the hull and abandon it there.
Really?
So some of them are abandonments. In fact, the really cool ones that you can see from a glass bottom boat in Alpena are abandoned vessels.
Wow, I wouldn't think there would be that many.
There's quite a few. I guess most of them in the sanctuary, those 100 that we talked about, were accidental sinkings. You know, weather, collisions, fire, groundings, that kind of thing.
Right.
But there are some that were abandoned.
I mean, you think about it. What do you do with a broken boat that's
right.
good anymore? Right?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not like you're just going to hurt it in the track.
That's right. Well, and if you think back even, you know, with dugout canoes and birch bark canoes,
yeah.
the reason we don't find a lot of those in the archaeological record is because those would be recycled, right?
Right.
So you could cut down a dugout canoe. If you're not going to use it anymore, you could make other things out of it.
Out of it, yeah.
I mean, that would be a really cool find. But
well, I know in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin,
yes.
there we talked. I actually talked to her at Canucopia last year.
Oh, did you?
Like, wow,
oh, so cool. I was so yeah. jealous when I saw that she found a dugout canoe. I was like,
then
I want to find.
One,
I know.
Right?
Gosh, I guess
that?
Right now that was really cool. We've got to have some. I mean, they got to be buried in the muck, though.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, they'll just deteriorate. But that's another reason we have that amazing preservation here in Lake Huron, just like over there, is the cold, fresh water.
Yeah.
So that it's like a schooner deep freeze, you know. I mean, it just keeps the wood intact. And that's why even in the shallow waters, which is much more dynamic area than the deep water, right?
Yep.
You got ice movement, wind and waves, sand shifting, but you still have those intact vessels. I mean, nearly intact. You can look down and see that it's a hull. Sometimes you can look and see an actual propeller.
Okay. Now, what is there a timeline that this area has?
Mm, great question. So we, at our exhibit, so the headquarters for the National Marine Sanctuary in Alpena, we have an awesome 10,000 square foot free museum
okay.
that talks all about the shipwreck century. So you asked about a timeline. We start the shipwreck century in 1825.
Okay.
Do you know why we choose 1825?
No.
Okay. You didn't know there'd be trivia, did you?
That's I didn't know there'd be a test in this program.
That's just the first question, too. You wait. The opening of the Erie Canal. And so that opened up the Great Lakes to all the industry and growth and immigration happening on the East Coast. So lots of shipping then.
Right.
And so the Erie Canal, 1825, begins what we call the shipwreck century. And then the next 100-plus years saw almost every type of vessel in the Great Lakes. Everything from old wooden schooners to huge steel freighters, similar to what we see working the Great Lakes today.
Right.
So, about 100 years is when you saw a lot of changes in ship construction design. Almost every vessel built, type of vessel built on the Great Lakes is represented in the collection on the bottom of the sanctuary. So that's pretty cool. We've got everything, like I said, the steamers, the sailing vessels. In 2017, we discovered a semi-whaleback, which is, there was only three like it built in all the Great Lakes.
Okay.
And we discovered the Choctaw in over 300 feet of water. You're not going to paddle to see that one.
Oh, I might go paddle and just look down and
right.
know it's there.
You know it's there. That's right.
That's, yeah, you know what? That makes sense. Because, I mean, until everything started coming up through,
right.
It's not like there's going to be a ton of ships on the Great Lakes, right?
That's right. That's right. And with the canal opening, it became one of the world's busiest waterways.
Yeah.
Still is today. It's just that, one of those big freighters that we see working the lakes can haul what 200 schooners did back during the shipwreck century.
Yeah. Is there a big difference between the wooden ships and the metal ships?
In, like, their preservation? Or
In contents. How many are down there?
Oh, gotcha. Oh,
I didn't know there would be hard questions.
You got me back. Well, I want to count that up now. How many wooden compared to? I think there might be more wooden, especially the shallower ones.
Yeah, I think I would think.
Now that I'm thinking through this, I'm thinking about the ones I've visited and paddled to and snorkeled to. One of my favorites is the wooden schooner called the Portland. Ran aground. In a storm,
okay.
1877, that's wooden, and it was carrying salt, no lives lost on that wreck. Another shallow one, the Albany, one of my favorites, in about 8 feet of water, and it's an old paddle wheeler, and massive, it's super old, like built in the, I think, 1840s, don't quote me on that. Sank in 1854 in another storm, and it's the timbers looking down at this wreck, always crystal clear at the Albany, and it's... The timbers are massive. They're like 2 foot square timbers.
Okay.
Just massive, massive. So I'm thinking, and I think we mainly have wooden vessels, although some of our deeper, really cool scuba diving shipwreck sites are like a 200 foot long steel freighter. One of my favorite sites, the Grecian, in about 100 feet of water.
That's not too far.
Yeah.
Now, we talk about paddling over these wrecks and stuff, which is pretty cool. And depending on the wreck, would probably be pretty eerie looking down, right?
Yeah.
But people can also, if they do it, they can snorkel these as well and scuba dive. I know, because I know your picture here in the book, so it shows you all in scuba gear.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking,
what's she talking about?
Talking about paddling. You're all in scuba gear here. So I don't see anybody falling out of a canoe in scuba gear.
That's right. Oh, you can.
Do people do it?
People do it. You could get a certain type of kayak, you know, like a pretty sturdy one, throw your scuba gear in there. Paddling and scuba diving go hand in hand. Heck yeah.
Really?
I've seen it happen. I have not done it. It seems kind of labor intensive. I'd rather be on a dive boat or else go kayaking.
Yeah. But no, that's pretty cool. Like I say, is when you're paddling up on some of these things, and you know the boat's there, and you look down, you don't, and then all of a sudden, boom!
Yeah,
there it is, right? Masted ships.
Yes.
Is there any that are like all of a sudden the mast is there?
All of a sudden on the shallow ones, not so much.
Right.
So the deeper ones, honestly, some of the deep schooners have their mast still standing, wooden mast standing upright 90 feet. In the water column. But you get those shallow ones, that kind of can be a navigation hazard.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Like, are they still there? The tops
right.
missing?
Right, right. And one of the shipwrecks that the Glass Bottom Boat visits, and it's a great shallow dive site, you could snorkel to this one, too. It's about 35 feet deep, just in the middle of Thunder Bay, the bay proper,
right.
At the Oscar T. Flint. And it's right in the shipping lane. So when it sank, they had to dynamite part of it to make it not a navigational hazard.
Ooh.
Yeah. But then thinking of another one, the Shamrock in that boneyard I was telling you about. I mean, that's about 17 feet deep. And its propeller is sticking up, you know, 8 feet. So there is some relief on these shallow wrecks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So is there any that are still sort of sticking up out of the water?
Oh, great question. One of my favorites is the Joseph S. Fay off of 40 Mile Point. And it is not sticking out of the water, but part of it's on the beach.
Okay.
And so if you haven't visited 40 Mile Point Lighthouse, it's just north of Rogers City, northeast Michigan, so about 45 minutes north of Alpena. And it's a perfect maritime place to visit because there's a lighthouse, there's a wheelhouse of an old freighter, there's a big lifeboat there, and then there's a shipwreck on the beach. And then you go out in the water, you can paddle out to the buoy, and I'll tell you about buoys here in a minute, and tie up and then jump in and snorkel the rest of the shipwreck in about 17 feet of water.
That's cool.
That's an adventure right there.
Right? I mean, that's your day.
That's right. Yeah. And then have a picnic. There's a lovely little picnic grounds there and a beach. It's awesome.
That's awesome. Buoys.
So one of our most important resource protection efforts is our mooring buoy program. And so we maintain mooring buoys on 52 of the shipwreck sites. And the sites ranging from those super shallow ones to super deep ones. And these buoys are awesome because they protect the shipwreck site because you don't have to drop anchor. And potentially, if you want to visit the site, you don't have to drop anchor if you're on a dive boat or fishing boat or sailboat or whatever, even a paddling boat, and potentially damage this historic shipwreck.
Right.
But it's also a way easier way to find a shipwreck site. You've got a buoy floating on the water. You see it from shore. You hop in with your kayak or your paddleboard, paddle right up to it, and then there's tag lines on them. And you can just tie up to the line, tie your craft up to that line on the buoy, and then jump in if you want, or just hang out for a bit, have your lunch, and then head in.
Is there any info on the buoy or anything about which?
It's the name. The name of the shipwreck is on there.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're blue and white. They stand out. And in fact, we have a great mooring buoy map on our website, thunderbay.noaa.gov.
Okay.
And you can go see where all the buoys are, see which ones are in. They're seasonal, of course, so we put them in early May, take them out in early October, and it's a great way to access these shipwreck sites.
Right. That's perfect. Historic ones. Is there any historic ones that are really significant out of all the ships?
Okay, that's another good question. So,
I mean, if you're tootling around, all of a sudden found the Queen Mary or something
right.
like that.
Right.
That's pretty significant.
Or like the Edmund Fitzgerald or something like that.
Yeah.
So, as a historian, I really would have to say they're all historically significant. There's no super duper famous ones like Titanic or, you know, that kind of thing or the Queen Mary. What's cool about them is they're representative. right? They're, if you want to really understand what a canal schooner is like, we got a whole bunch of those.
Right.
And so I'm racking my brain right now trying to think of, like, super famous ones. That Choctaw, that semi-whaleback that we discovered in 2017, was famous in shipwreck history circles for sure, right, because people had been looking for it. Only one of three built, you know, so that's pretty significant. You may have stumped me on a real I know there's
is there any that have been people were looking for, and then finally someday, wow.
Yes. Like, I actually just did a lecture on our five most recent discoveries, and we announced the fifth in March of last year, so just about a year, almost exactly a year ago, and it was the Ironton, and it was a schooner that people had been looking for decades. We discovered the vessel it collided with in 2017. Okay. And so when we discovered the Ohio, the one it collided with, people are like, well, where's the Ironton? You know, because we looked around. You'd think they'd be pretty close. They weren't so close. And then the next time we were able to go out and continue looking and continue mapping, we eventually did find the Ironton. So that one was pretty well-received news when we discovered that shipwreck. Lots of people were looking for that one.
Well, and that's it. If there's one people are looking for, and you know, because those are, I would imagine, could be the ones that are a bit deeper.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
Yeah, but there are still some shallow ones to find, I'm sure. I mean, like we talked about earlier, the dynamic nature of shallow Great Lakes, right? Things are changing all the time with the sand. That's exactly right. Yeah.
What's the technology nowadays to find?
To look for shipwrecks, we use remote sensing technology, those deeper wrecks. So we send out vessels, whether they're autonomous vessels or like little small operated from shore boats, maybe 10 feet long, okay, or one of our big research vessels, 50 foot long, will have multi-beam sonar mounted to the hull.
Okay.
And that sends out sound waves. And then how those sound waves come back to the multi-beam sonar tells you what the lake bottom looks like. So it tells you the relief, and it tells you the shapes on the bottom, whether it's a big chunk of rocks or whether it's a shipwreck.
Okay.
So that's how we get an idea of what the lake floor looks like. And it's pretty interesting that only about 15% of the Great Lakes have been mapped to high resolution, to high detail. So they've been mapped, of course, with low resolution enough to navigate and to understand it, basically. But to that high resolution within a couple meters where, you know, it was real important for managing these areas, for biologists to understand fish habitat, for geologists to understand the topography, the bathymetry of the lake bottom, we have a lot of work to do to go out with those remote sensing technologies and understand the lake bottom.
Right.
So we've actually, all of our mapping efforts contribute to an initiative called Lakebed 2030, which is a really cool grassroots initiative where universities and public agencies and private businesses and individuals, you know, that spend a lot of time on the water are out there mapping and then contributing that data to this Lakebed 2030 initiative. So we have, hopefully, the goal is to have the Great Lakes mapped to high resolution by 2030.
That'd be cool.
Which is creeping up on us, isn't it?
Right, yeah. Closer and closer.
That's right.
6 years away now. Yeah. No, that's pretty cool. Now, the best place, if you're saying, to go out, if you wanted to paddle and see wrecks, out of Alpena?
Absolutely. Well, there's out of Northeast Michigan. I would say start your sanctuary shipwreck paddling adventure in Alpena at the Sanctuary's Visitor Center, the Great Lakes Maritime Heritage Center. Big blue NOAA building right on the Thunder Bay River. Open year-round, free admittance, and it's 10,000 square feet of maritime exhibits. Start there, and you can learn the history about the shipwrecks. Talk to the historians there. Go shopping in the gift store. Supports the Friends of the Sanctuary, which we do a lot of education programs, so that's super cool.
Right.
And that's where you're going to learn where to put in. You can put in just down the street from there, or you can go to downtown Alpena just off the breakwall. But then traveling north, there's Presque Isle and Rockport State Park are some great places to put in. And then south of Alpena, down in the Harrisville area and Black River, there's some shallow shipwrecks. So there's lots and
lots
of shipwrecks to see.
Now, I presume you guys would sell a map that people can know where to go?
Absolutely, and we don't sell it because, you know, like we're...
Or just giving away?
We're giving away because, we're like I said, we're like national park, but underwater, so we're part of a national system. So federal government shouldn't... They're not selling stuff. So we're giving it, right? We're just a public service.
Away, yeah.
Public service here for the people. And, you know, just to mention, there are 15 national marine sanctuaries across the whole U.S., and we were the very first one in freshwater. And so pretty cool, designated in the year 2000 because of all these shipwrecks we've been talking about. But the National Marine Sanctuary System protects over 620,000 square miles of America's special places underwater.
Wow.
So it's a vast system that we're a part of. But yes, to answer your question, you can get lots of free information at thunderbay.noaa, so NOAA.gov. And that's where we have our mooring buoy map. We have a paddle snorkel guide, which lists our, like, you know, star shallow shipwrecks to visit and how to find them, where to put in, a little bit of history about them. But, yeah, that website, thunderbay.noaa.gov, is the place to go.
Awesome. One may not be the last question, but for now, I know when we go out, we're doing fishing and stuff like that, there's plenty of times that we'll catch a piece of wood that has zebra mussels.
Uh-huh.
Are they having an effect on the wrecks?
Great question. So, yes, the zebra quagga mussels are everywhere, right? And they do habitate the wrecks. they grab onto them. And they don't eat the wrecks, though. So that's a good thing.
Right.
But they do weigh them down. So, and they obliterate details. So that's the effect they would have on it. They obviously, we all know they have an effect on the entire ecosystem.
Yeah.
But they don't eat the wrecks, but they can weigh them down and maybe make them fall apart a little sooner than they would if without the mussels. And then, you know, archaeologists, when we're looking to identify a shipwreck or understand a site, there's those details that those mussels are obliterating that we can't really see.
Right.
So...
You do the best you can.
That's right. That's right.
Right. Is there anything, any ships that you think you may be on track of that might be hopefully found in the next while?
That we're looking for?
Yeah.
So, we have a really cool map. When you come visit out the visitor center, there's a huge map that has all the shipwrecks that we found and then all the projected ones we think are out there. And so we're going to go out mapping every season until we have the whole 4,300 square miles map. So I evaded that question because I don't have a specific one we're looking for. The goal really is just to map the whole lake
just
bottom.
Just keep finding them.
Keep mapping, keep finding them.
Which begs the question, if I'm out there paddling, I look down, I go, there's no buoy around here, this ain't on a map.
Ah.
And I happen to see something down there. Who do I contact?
You contact the state of Michigan. And then, in fact, the marine sanctuary is co-managed by NOAA and the state of Michigan.
Okay.
So contact the state and report it, and that's really important to do. So that's a great question you ask, because some, you know, we talked about those. There could be, they could move. The shipwrecks could move. It could be a newly uncovered site that the state doesn't have in the database. So there's a great website that the state has. I don't have it off the top of my head, but if you Google State of Michigan shipwreck reporting, you'll get to it.
Okay.
And there's a form and everything right there, so it can be added to the database.
Awesome. One more time, where do we find you guys on the web?
Thunderbay.noaa.gov.
Perfect. Stephanie, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hopefully I can get down there and do some paddling over the wrecks.
Yes, let me know.
Cool.
Yes, it's super cool. Let me know when you come.
Can do. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, well, I hope you guys enjoyed those interviews. And
I know I did.
We always enjoy listening to that sort of stuff. And it's nothing like being there for in person, though.
Exactly. It's nice to attend in person. There's so many things to see at the QAS. It's in a great location. It's great people that attend. I've enjoyed my times there every single time I've gone. Afterwards, everybody goes to the Eagle Monk Pub and has some dinner and some stories afterwards. It's always fun. It's always fun.
It definitely is. And again, if you have any way to volunteer time or resources to help out and keep this show going, definitely head over to quietadventures.org website there and contact them, see what it's all about, and let them know what you can do to help out. And let's just keep this thing going, because the next spring I expect to be heading across the border to
QAS.
To QAS again. Until then, if you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, and you can download or stream our episodes at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites, or just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.